So, the word of the Buddha. Now, we're continuing on with Samaditti, which is the right view, a right understanding. And last week, we went through the 62 wrong views, and also some of the right views, especially about anatta, which seems to be the central view of right view. Make sure there's understanding, there's nobody in here. And we got to page 35, we're just about the 10 Sangyojanas. And Sangyojanas literally means to be tied along with. In fact, a yojana is a measure of distance in Pali. It's how far a team of oxen who are tied together can travel in one day. And that's a yojana. So Sangyojana means literally yoked together. So what it means is what yokes you, what ties you, just like one ball is tied to another ball, this is what ties you to the wheel of existence, the wheel of rebirth. The 10 fetters by which beings are bound to the wheel of existence. They are the self-illusion, Sakkaya Ditti, which was talking about a lot, means you assume that either in any of the 5 khandhas there is a self, or the 5 khandhas contain a self, or the same as the self, or sometimes possessed of a self. In other words, it's somehow or other is a self attached or owning these 5 khandhas. And it's the skepticism, the doubt about the teachings of the Buddha, the attachment to mere rules and ritual, which I explained, it's actually another view, the view that just by the sila, like the 5 sila, the 8 sila, or the 227th sila, the batteries, the duties, just by holding on to them, that's sufficient to be able to become enlightened. Those are the first 3 fetters, and they are overcome by a stream winner. Then you have sensual lust, karma raga, which means not just lust, it means any desire in the 5 sense realm. Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. The word karma, K-A-M-A, does not refer to the 6th sense, just to the 5 senses. That's why it's called karma loka. And you've got ill will, vayapada. Very easy to understand. And then you have the craving or desire or lust for 5 material existence, for rupa, and that's usually for the rupa jhanas or for the states based on those which you can get reborn into after death, or the arupa raga for the immaterial existences, or conceit, mana, restlessness, udicca, and lastly, avijja, ignorance or delusion. The 10 fetters. And this is straight, sort of, even though this is Nyaya Tilaka's commentary, this is straight from the suttas. One who is freed from the first 3 fetters is called a stream enterer, or stream winner. Are you one who has entered a stream leading to Nibbana? They have unshakable faith in the Buddha, Dhamma, and the Sangha, and they are incapable of breaking the 5 moral precepts. They will be reborn 7 times at the utmost, and not in a state lower than the human world. There are 2 mistakes in that. Who knows what those 2 mistakes are? 6 times? I thought they only had 7 more lifetimes. No. Yeah, you've been here before. Big. Yeah. It's just the ancient way. When you are born, you're 1 year old. So, you know, it's just 7 lifetimes means including this one. So you have this one plus 6 extra. So it means 6 more rebirths at most. So sometimes it's when Westerners read the like an Asian language, sometimes they miss that. It's the same as monks. You can keep your, say, sugar for 7 days. That actually only means 6.5 days or 6.75 days, but not in the full 7 days. So that's how it works. So it's really good. So if you're in Asia, you can actually retire 1 year earlier than when you're in 65, means on your 64th birthday. Anyway, let's get back to this. What's the second mistake? Correct. You still can break the 5 precepts, but you always have to confess it afterwards. You can't hide your sort of breaking the precepts, but you can still break them.
The main point is that they won't break any rules to a degree that will bring them to a lower rebirth.
indeed, and they won't be able to do that, but also that their morality will improve enormously, but they're still able to break the five precepts. But they would, they confess it straight away. They won't sort of hide it. Any sort of unwholesome karma, they can't really sort of conceal or hide it. One who has overcome the fourth and fifth fetters in their grosser form is called a Sakadagami, literally once returner. They will be reborn only once more in the sensuous sphere, the Karmaloka, and thereafter reach holiness. Okay, but what does it mean, sort of, in their grosser form? This is, what is it? Unshakable faith in Buddha. They have broken sensual lust and ill will. What do you mean in the grosser form? It means they don't have like lust for gross women. Is that what gross form means? They don't have. What does it mean?
It means those forms of sexual lust in the world which create a lot of tension in one.
Well, actually, basically, that's a question which no one has answered. Because don't actually say what answer exactly how much or what type of sensual lust. It means it's actually weakened anyway. So you haven't got the same sort of sensual desires as a normal person. But it doesn't actually say how much.
Yeah, I also found it very interesting when I was listening to Achandan. He was actually saying that at the first stage, it's like a third that goes, and then the second third, and then the third third.
Yeah, well, you can't say that, because that's...
well,
yeah, say. But I mean, it's a portion that's gone. Yeah?
I have a question. Even for the... when you have
First of all, the Buddha is, you know, unless you've actually touched what the Buddha has touched and saw what the Buddha has seen, which is, say, non-self, emptiness, whatever, see your first glimpse of Nibbana, then you don't really know what a Buddha is. So because of that, that experience of non-self, that experience of stream winner, gives you a huge insight into actually what a Buddha is. And, you know, they say, when you see the Buddha, you see the Dhamma. When you see the Dhamma, you see the Buddha. That's exactly the same meaning. So one of the experiences of stream winning is now you really understand what the Buddha was and what incredible thing he did. And you understand the important part of the Dhamma, things like non-self. And then the Sangha, the faith in the Sangha, in this particular case it is Arya Sangha, now there actually you have unshakable faith that, yeah, there are other beings as well as the Buddha. You understand the process, and you are one of those Aryans. So you have unshakable faith because, you know, you're one of those.
It's like the result of the training.
Yeah, oh yeah.
That's the way we understand having faith in the Buddha and the Sangha.
Correct, yeah. So, if it was a monk or a nun who was a stream winner, could they disrobe? No, no, I would say, could they disrobe, yes or no?
Yes.
Yes. But then they're getting, they've got unshakable faith in the Sangha.
Well, they might think, I've got six lifetimes left, so...
The girl might be too pretty.
They don't lose their liberation, but it might be that they have this central desire.
What do you think?
Oh, definitely, they could as well if they wanted to.
It's the past inclinations.
But could they want to? What about their will being sort of changed?
But karma, if the karma is there...
there was a Visakha, he was an anagami, but he didn't take confirmation.
Yeah, there was, but they usually had sort of problems with their family. I would actually say usually that if one was a stream winner, the chances of one disrobing are very, very, very small. It has to be something really extreme to make you disrobe. But anyway, so I can't.
T-shirt, looks like the Sakadagami wasn't angry with the world. That was it.
Okay. Well, I will leave that one. So that's the Sakadagami, and I don't actually know exactly how much they get reborn. So Sakadagamis, does it mean they all have to get reborn into this earth to become an arahant? So how many rebirths does the Sakadagami have after this life?
Well, you don't know. It's just one coming back into this world.
Do they come back straight away?
They don't have to. I think a lot of them don't.
So what do they do?
They go to some heavenly
and they go on there? No. So how many, what's the maximum number of rebirths a Sakadagami has? Sorry? Maximum number. That's right, two.
Two.
Yeah. Because they get reborn in the heaven realm. And they come back here, it's number two.
But do they stand, you know, let's take it, that they do get bored in the heavenly realm?
Usually, yes. It says, sutta there, it says, for the most part, it's a commentary, but it makes a lot of sense, that for the most part, I think it's a sutta, for the most part, Sakadagamis get reborn in the Tusita realm.
And they can't kind of have a heavenly rebirth and then another.
That's right, they have a break, have a holiday.
No, but they can't have two or three of them and then come down?
That's an interesting, where they go to Tusita realm, and then say, well, you know, we're going to leave soon. Better check out the sort of the other realms as well. Then before we go, it's an interesting question. Maybe
nice
more.
Up there.
Maybe why, more. Yeah. One after they should choose it and then back again. Yeah.
You know, when, okay. So, stream
winning
that they. I remember hearing the Dhammacakkappa mention. So, when the stream winner, he knows it's going to happen because I think of the recollection. You know,
this is an interesting point. Yeah. Because for a Sakadagami, sort of there you are, someone who's just lessened these two things. I mean, how do they know exactly how much is lessened? So an Anagami, it's very clear to know if you're an Anagami or not. Very clear to know a stream winner or an Arahat. But a Sakadagami is just very, very unclear whether you are a Sakadagami or not. And that's probably one of the reasons is in the Sanyutta there was a sutta there with the two, I think they were brothers, Isidatta and Purana. And the Buddha said both of them were Sakadagamis, once returners. And the monks were very quite concerned about that because one had a wife and the other one was actually celibate, kept eight precepts. He said, how can this be? And he said, oh, the one who was celibate, you know, he had a very, very good morality. So he was very, very strong on that one. But his brother, who had a wife, he was very strong on wisdom. They were actually both once returners. So it's actually quite hard to tell that one. But Anagamis are very easy to say. And that's why also that sutta in the Anguttara about the seven shipwrecked sailors, there's a very beautiful sutta there, that the stream winner is a shipwrecked sailor who's floating, sees the land. So he can see where the safety is. That's the stream winner. And the Sakadagami is swimming. It doesn't say how far he swam or she swam, how far is left to go. They're just on the way. And the Anagami is one who's standing in the surf.
Does it have difference, let's say, someone becomes a stream winner in his life, and then throughout the whole life, let's say they are arahant, let's say, so throughout the life, do they know other events? Do they know, now this is my marriage, you know, and this is the point where.
That's actually, the Buddha actually says that in the sutta, just like the person who uses the axe. By the person who uses an axe, they know that this much of the axe handle is worn away. This much is still left to be worn away. So it was one of the sayings of the Buddha. If you look, you can actually see. Non-returner, yeah. I would say that was an event, yes. For a non-returner, for an arahat. And because it's just like the simile. You actually can feel the ground underneath you as you step down.
Okay, so each
those three are events. I think the Sakadagami is the tough one.
Except for the Sakadagami.
Yeah.
And then in order for them to not say if something happens, in order for them to analyze or something.
Yeah, have to have some enough mindfulness, not all your mindfulness, really strong mindfulness to see what's left. Of course not. No, I don't know, that's right. There's a very famous case of Suman and the novice. And he was only a sort of novice, And like these days, people used to tease the novice, and the monks would sometimes knock him on the head, you know, to sort of go and get things, or so to pull him by the ears. And when they saw, the Buddha saw him do, some of the monks doing this with similar novice on arms round, he called all the novices, all the monks together, and said, "Be careful, because that little novice, the previous day, he was asked to get some water from this magical lake in the Himalayas. To get that water, he had to fight this dragon, and he defeated this dragon by standing on the dragon's head and pushing it in under the water." He said, "No, he flew there by." He said, "Arahat with great psychic powers, and you monks are pulling his ears, and he could actually just waste you just with, you know, one moment, zap, yeah." And that's where the Buddha gave the simile of, it was the four small things you've got to be afraid of. So small fires, because small fires can be a big bushfire. Small snakes, because, you know, snakes, even though they're very tiny, they can still be very poisonous and do you damage. They say small princes, because one day they may grow up to be king, and they remember what you did to them, and you'll be in trouble then. And the other one is young, sort of, novices. Or even young monks, young nuns, or even young anagarikas. Because you don't know what they've been doing. So don't go and knock a fellow anagarika on the head. He may zap you and that's it. So that's what you say, you can't tell by what people are. So, I just mentioned, before we go into anagamis and stuff, I mentioned that sort of the once returners, it says that most, by the most part, they get reborn in the Tusita realm. So, who was one of the most famous once returners who got reborn in the Tusita realm and then came back to Earth for his last life?
The Buddha himself.
But was he a once returner? Well, actually, well, he, according to the story, which is actually in the suttas here, he said he took seven steps and said, "This is my last birth." How could he know that? Unless he was a once returner. Debatable, but there's circumstantial evidence to say Gautama was a once returner. He was a monk under Gatikara. Monk under Kasapa the Buddha. And from there, he got reborn in the Tusita realm, it seems, and came back again. That is consistent. No, he only said it was a bodhisattva after he came down from the Tusita realm. That's the only time he used the word bodhisattva. Okay, so an anagami is wholly freed from the first five fetters which bind one to rebirth in the sensual sphere. After death, while living in the fine material sphere, they will reach the goal. So, how do you know if they're an anagami? They've got no ill will. So how do you know that? You call them stupid, you call them ugly, you call them an idiot, to see if they get angry at you. And if they get angry at you, sorry, you failed the test. So that's much easier to know if you're an anagami. And they get reborn into the Sudarvasa, the pure abodes. And you can see the Sudarvasa and the pure land. You can see those are so close together that it was actually Dr. Kesia Dhammananda, he was suggesting that the Mahayana got that pure land as a misunderstanding of the pure abodes, of the place where anagamis go to. So in anagami, you go to that pure abode. What happens there? That's where you pass away, because you only got no lust for the five senses, there's no ill will, all you've got is, what have you got left, the anagami? What five fetters have you still got? Conceit. What does that mean? They think, I'm an anagami, look at me. I'm much better than the Sakadagamis, you hopeless once-returner scallywags. You know, I'm a once-returner. I'm a non-returner. Is that what conceit means?
They're still attached to their awareness. They still think there's something that is kind of me.
Okay, yeah, that's actually what's one of the descriptions in the suttas there. But conceit, is in Pali, doesn't mean the same as the word English. It means a conceiving of I am somewhere. There's still a sense of me there. So what they must be identifying with is, you know, their knowing, especially their knowing of these beautiful bliss states of the jhanas or the immaterial states, because that is where they have their sort of delight. So the delight, those rupa raga and arupa raga, which is literally delighting in those jhanic-like states. And amana is a sense of self which comes up from that. And udacha, still restless, not always still, jhanas come, jhanas go. What about avijja? They're still deluded. Sure, they can't have delusion because they've seen the Dhamma at the time of street winning. So how can they have delusion? I'll answer your question later after this. Yeah. The best explanation of that is with the vipalasas, which if you were here last year, you'd know that's the explanation of the first sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya. This is the way that your cognitive processes are deluded, how they're bent. And there's three levels on view, perception and thought. Because your view will bend your perception to fit. Basically, things which you don't want to see, you won't perceive. But what you like to see, that's what you do perceive. For example, when you go to the lunch tomorrow morning, you'll find that the food you like, you actually perceive. The food you don't like, you hardly see is there. Your perception is very much bent by likes and dislikes, by views. And so from your perceptions, that's the bricks which build up your thoughts. So you think perception is raw perception. No such thing as raw perception or bare perception. It's already been bent by the time it comes to your attention. So for a anagami, the view is perfect. But still there's an old habit, bending your perceptions and your thoughts to I am or I delight. So basically, the right view is perfect, but the right perception, the right thought have not yet become strong enough to call themselves the arahant.
Does that mean you still have kinesis?
Yes, because the perceptions and the thoughts are still there. So, but it's very refined kinesis. You can hardly call them kinesis, it's just the attachment to the sense of it. So that's the delusion. It's not delusion on the sense of view. They've got perfect understanding of the Dhamma. They're just deluded in perception and thought. That's why we prefer to call it delusion rather than ignorance or illusion. Because they're not ignorant, they know everything. It's just their perceptions and their thoughts are sometimes deluded. Yes?
When we're conscious, when we're aware of, let's say, a view, it's not actually the view of perception?
Well, the view is almost like the framework, you understand? Anicca, Dukkha, Anatta, Four Noble Truths, that type of view. View is fundamental, yeah. You always have the ideas of, like if you view that football is very important, then you'll spend this evening watching a football match rather than the Dhamma. If that's your view, that'll bend your perception. And you'll think, wow, this is really much more important. And you'll enjoy it. So you see how that views actually bend your perceptions and bend your truth. If you're a Christian, you know, you believe that, how can you Buddhists not believe in God? It's obvious. God is all around, can't you see it? Because the view actually will bend that perception. And that's why intelligent people, what's that, Heaven's Gate. Once you have the view that there's an asteroid God, like today, Eddie, you have the view that in 2012 the world is going to change. If you have that view, you can actually see the signs, perceive it, it's obvious, and you can't understand why other people can't see what you're seeing. So the view actually bends perceptions in a big way. Yeah. Correct.
Processes by itself, whether that's
you right. Forget about that, whether you think that. Correct. So once the right view is there, all your perceptions and thoughts will eventually fall into line. At the very slowest, after six more births. Once the view is there, all that delusion cannot sort of hold for much longer. Perceptions will come into line, thoughts will come into line with the Dhamma. And when they do, that's when you're an arahant.
It's very interesting that recently, in the last 10 years, people have jhana. Before that, they used to think you can't have a jhana.
Yeah.
Jhana is impossible.
Correct.
Now, look at the internet. Everyone's had it.
Yeah, I won't comment on that one. An arahat is a perfectly holy one, is freed from all the 10 fetters. Each of the aforementioned 4 stages of holiness consists of path and fruition. Path of stream winner and fruition of stream winner. That's just very correct. Accordingly, there are 8 types or 4 pairs of noble individuals. That's what we say in the Itipi So, or in the Sawaka Sangha. What is it? Atapugala Pugala. Atapurisa Pugala. The eight types of beings, the Chataro, the 4 pairs. So we have those. But the path consists of a single moment of entering the respective attainment. Boo! That is really ridiculous. And one of the great arguments, so this is one which Venerable Gunaratna wrote about a long time ago. He said, look, if it's only a single moment, you would not be able to give alms to someone on the path to being a stream winner, on the path to something else. So because it's very clear you can give alms to such people, it must last much more than a single moment. And it's one of the suttas which actually says that someone on the path to being a stream winner, once you enter the path, it does take a long time, and sometimes it will take up to the rest of your life. And really, someone on the path to being a stream winner, no, you have to get the fruit before you pass away. And so there's a certain type of person, they say, so slow that the universe is about to end, and you actually hold up the universe, because the universe cannot end until you become a stream winner. So you're called a person who stops the ending of the universe. So anyway, that's a bit sort of going a bit far, but it actually does actually show that the path does not just precede the fruit.
That so we have to do that before that meteorite thing. Eh?
That's right, yeah. Meteor has to stop while you're sort of getting your stream in. So anyway, what it means is the path does not precede the fruit by a single moment. That's Abhidharma, and that's clearly wrong. By fruition, I meant those moments of consciousness which follow immediately after that. That's all Abhidharma rubbish. Now we get some more Abhidharma rubbish. I have to say this because, therefore, I say right understanding is of 2 kinds, mundane and supermundane understanding. They don't call it supermundane at all. Venerable Analia was one of the first people to actually look at this and see that this is actually a sutta which is not in the Chinese versions of it's not in the Agamas. It's one of the very few which has not got its parallel in the Chinese versions. And number 2, that some of these sayings, especially on number 2 here, is actually lifted wholesale from the Abhidharma. So this is one sutta where it's pretty clear it's been added afterwards. But nevertheless, the view that alms and offerings are not useless, in other words, it's good to sort of clean up after the lunch, and it's good to cook things and offer the food to the monks, to make offerings, to give donations. It's not useless. So there is fruit and result both of good and bad actions. There are such things as this life and the next life, in other words, reincarnation. That father and mother are no mere words, first of all. That means that it's important to look after your mum and dad. And spontaneously born beings means like devas and ghosts, because if you become a deva, you don't get reborn into a deva's tummy and get born. You don't have to go to kindy if you're a deva. Once you actually get reborn as a deva, you are fully formed. You're mature straight away. So you don't actually grow up in the deva realm. You're fully mature as soon as you spontaneously arise there with all your faculties until you sort of fade away. So there's no sort of sense of growing up. So spontaneously born beings. And there are in this world monks and priests who are spotless and perfect, who can explain this life and the next life, reincarnation, which they themselves have understood. In other words, actually you can know for a fact that there is such a thing as rebirth. This is called Lokiya, mundane is the wrong word, because mundane understanding is that, you know, beer is tasty, or gold is a good thing to invest in the stock market. That's mundane right now. So this is still sort of not mundane, but Lokiya means it's part of this world, part of rebirth. It yields worldly fruit and brings good results, but you can't call it mundane, because the word mundane means just ordinary. But whatsoever there is of wisdom, of penetration, of right understanding, conjoined with the path, the mind being turned away from the world and conjoined with the path, the holy path being sealed, this is called the supermundane right understanding, which is not of the world, but is supermundane and conjoined with the path. That is straight out of the Abhidharma. It's been lifted. But anyway, this is the thing which really sort of upsets me. I mean, the Jnana Taloka actually didn't do his research properly. The Lokiya, thus there are two kinds of Eightfold Path. The mundane, practicing by the worldling, but all those have not yet reached the first stage of holiness, and the super mundane, practiced by the noble ones. And this is actually quoted from Majjhima 117, the Mahachatarasa Sutta. And please have a look at it, and there you see that even there, that distinction is only used for the first five factors of the Eightfold Path. For right view, right thought, right speech, action, livelihood, but not for the last three factors. So there is no such thing as mundane or super mundane effort. No such thing as mundane or super mundane mindfulness. And certainly no such thing as mundane or super mundane jhana. And that really sort of riles me when some people say, oh, mundane jhana, super mundane jhana. There's no basis for that in the suttas at all. And number two, anyone who's achieved a jhana, the last thing you call it is mundane. This is actually it's an uttari manusa dhamma, according to the Vinaya. It's an incredibly refined state. And not many people, it's not a mundane thing to get into jhana. So when people call mundane jhanas, they say, come off it, you know, you're misrepresenting the teachings. So anyway, I'll read that out there. And this is also from that sutta. In understanding, wrong understanding is wrong, and right understanding is right, one practices a form of right understanding. Yeah, I suppose so.
Would the reverse analysis also be true with the vipassana jhanas, which you say are mundane, are not mundane at all?
Well, first of all, there's no such thing as vipassana jhanas. That word doesn't exist in the suttas. So jhanas are jhanas are jhanas. So the thing is a jhana. How it arrives at, you know, there always has to be some insight, there always has to be some metta, there always has to be some samatha. So you can't have, that's what this first 372 of Javapada says. Nati jhana apanyasa panya nati jayato. There's no jhana without wisdom. There's no wisdom without jhana. So the first one, no jhana without wisdom. You have to have insight to get jhana. So in that sense, all jhanas are vipassana jhanas. All jhanas are metta jhanas. All jhanas are samatha jhanas. So that's why the idea of a vipassana jhana is a different class of jhanas. Can't accept that. It's not in the suttas either. So, right understanding is right understanding. And in making efforts to overcome wrong understanding, to arise right understanding, one practices a form of right effort. And in overcoming wrong understanding with attentive mind and dwelling with attentive mind, in the possession of right understanding, one practices right mindfulness. Hence, there are three things that accompany and fall upon right understanding, namely right understanding, right effort, and right mindfulness. That really never sort of impressed me, because that was just a bit sort of contrived, you know, with each one of these, but they keep on saying this for all of these steps. Nevertheless, free from all theories. Now we get into more interesting stuff. Now, if anyone should put the question whether I admit any theory at all, he should be answered thus. The perfect one is free from any theory, for the perfect one has understood what body is, how it arises and passes away, has understood what feeling is, and how it arises and passes away, has understood what perception is, and how it arises and passes away, has understood what mental formations are, and how they arise and pass away, has understood what consciousness is, and how it arises and passes away. Therefore I say the perfect one has won complete deliverance through the extinction, fading away, and disappearance, rejection, and getting rid of all opinions and conjectures, of all inclination to the vain glory, the conceit of I and mine. Isn't that his opinion? What's the difference between an opinion and right view? When I was in Thailand, we used to have this saying that when you're a young monk, it's called opinions, but when you become a teacher, it's called Dhamma.
Well, an opinion is not always based on experience.
Okay.
Really knowing.
Very good. So this is why it's theories. In other words, just conjectures, theories. But when it's based on your personal experience, real true understanding, especially understanding based on the absence of the five hindrances. Because it's the five hindrances, which the Buddha says, which weaken wisdom, which actually basically are the mechanism which bend perception and bend thinking and bend your views. So once the five hindrances are gone, then you can pretty much trust what you see. Mitya-ditti, yeah. But we can have all sorts of theories.
Where's the cat? It can't from the sutras.
Oh, yes, this is from the sutras. Oh, what?
Huh?
Sorry?
Is that translated wrong? It shouldn't be theory,
then. Oh, no. It is a theory. A theory is a good idea, because a theory is, you know, especially in science, you put the theory up there, and you get people to sort of try and disprove it, and if it sort of stands peer review, stands experiments, then it becomes a law. So you have a theory of gravity, and then after all it becomes a law of gravity. Okay. The three characteristics. Whether the Buddhas appear in the world or whether Buddhas do not appear in the world, it still remains a firm condition and an immutable fact and fixed law. In other words, there is something which is permanent. You can't say that everything is impermanent. That all formations are impermanent. That's sankharas. All sankharas are subject to suffering. That everything is without a self. In Pali, sabbe sankhara anicca, sabbe sankhara dukkha, sabbe dhamma anattati. It's a very old saying. I think that's carved somewhere in some rock. So this was very early. The word sankhara comprises here all things that are conditioned or formed, i.e. all possible physical and mental constituents of existence, such as will is formed, you can see how it's formed, consciousness is formed, the six types of consciousness, the body is formed, feeling and perceptions, they're all formed, they're actually built, you can actually see how they come about, the causes and results. The word Dhamma, however, has still a wider application and is all-embracing, as it also comprises the so-called unconditioned, unformed, asangatai, nibbana. For this reason, it would be wrong to say that all dhammas are impermanent and subject to change, for the nibbana dhamma is permanent and free from change. It's actually just being a waste of time talking about this. And for the same reason, it is correct to say that not all the sankharas, but that all the dhammas, like an ego. Anyway, a corporal phenomena, a feeling, a perception, a mental formation of consciousness, any one of these, any type of these, which is permanent and persistent, eternal and not subject to change, such a thing the wise men and women in this world do not recognize. And I also say there is no such thing. It's a very powerful statement. I love that one. Saying that any body, any feeling, just bliss forever and ever, any perception, any mental formation, any type of consciousness, which is permanent, persistent, eternal, not subject to change, such a thing I do not recognize, nor do the wise people in this world. There is no such thing.
This is a refutation of the God and heaven and all that.
God in heaven, cosmic consciousness, original consciousness, ground of all being, all that sort of stuff. It refutes very clearly, very powerfully.
This is a sticky point. As Buddhists, when someone comes to you and preaches the Christian, as Buddhists, we're supposed to say that's wrong.
Yeah. It's nice to just...
But this is very difficult to tell someone this.
Well, look, there was this great Bhante Gunaratna... No, yeah, Bhante Gunaratna told me this. That there was... when Bhante Ji and there was... I think Piyadasi was there as well, and Kesavi Dhammananda and his monk Ananda Mangala, they were all staying in brickfields in Malaysia a long time ago when they were young monks. And these Christian missionaries came in to talk to them. And Ananda Mangala, he just wasted no breath at all. He looked, when he found out the mission, he said, "Get out of here, you bloody fools." He swore at them. And of course they left, and all the other monks said, "You're not supposed to swear, but thank you for doing that. We saved a lot of time." So that becomes a great attitude, yeah. Just say, "Get out of here, you bloody fools." Every time, though, I remember a case we'd done with Tony, he was laughing his head off. Because it was one of those things that, you know, some monks they would love to say, but they haven't got the guts to say it. This monk, he didn't care what other people thought of him, he just said it. Yeah, you can do that, but you've got to be careful, because they've probably already heard that one, and they've sort of got an answer for it. But get out of here, you bloody fools. It's really sort of a good one. And it is impossible that a being possessed of right understanding should regard anything as a self. A being possessed of right understanding, right view, that is a stream winner. Another great saying. It's impossible that a stream winner should regard anything as being their self, their ego. That's one of the standards. Now, views and discussions about the self. If someone should say that feeling is their self, you know, this happiness or suffering, because you have the idea that if you really get to sort of enlightenment, you've got this perfect bliss. So your bliss is you. That's the real me. If ever you got into meditation, and everything's going really peaceful, it's like, this is the real me. And yeah, the other time I'm just, you know, making mistakes. It's not the real me when I'm sort of stupid. Yeah, just having a bad day, but it's not the real me. You say there are three kinds of feeling, pleasurable, painful, and indifferent feeling. Which of these three feelings do you consider as yourself? Which one? I'd actually say the pleasurable feeling. But the thing is, it's just pleasure doesn't last. Because at the moment of experience of one of these feelings, one does not experience the other two. These three kinds of feelings are impermanent, of dependent origin, are subject to decay and dissolution, to fading away and extinction. Whosoever in experiencing one of these feelings that thinks that this is his self, mind the pleasure, I'm the bliss, must after the extinction of that feeling admit that his self has also become extinct. So where's my self gone when I'm suffering? So in other words, thus he will consider his self already in his present life as impermanent, mixed up with pleasure and pain, subject to rising and passing away. So you can't actually identify with, say, any feeling as being a self. So if you actually go to your real self, and at the end of your life, you know, you actually get to the real self, and there you're one with the self, the real self, and all this impermanent sort of yucky self, it disappears and go to the core of you, it can't be happy, it can't be suffering, it can't be in between. Mm-hmm. So it must not exist.
Sometimes you hear self, let's say it's not the body, it's not the five senses, it's not really fun, but sort of posited somewhere.
Well, this is actually where you try and pin people down. You say, you know, it contains these five senses. This is what the Buddha does. You know, it's just basically it just covers all exits, so you can't sort of eel wiggle anymore. So let's go further. We actually go further in the same. If one should say that feeling is not myself, and that myself is inaccessible to feeling, so it's actually beyond all this happiness and pleasure stuff, should be asked, now where there's no feeling, is it possible then even to imagine this is me? There cannot be any self-consciousness without feeling, because with feeling, that's where consciousness arises. But in other words, if there is no feeling, there's unconsciousness. Where there's consciousness, there must always be pleasurable, pain, or somewhere in between. You can't have a state of consciousness without that. So what it's actually saying here, where there's no feeling, you're unconscious. So what's the point? To say, now, I am, but I'm not conscious. It's like being, the Buddha actually said, like an old log in the forest. It doesn't make any sense. Another might say, feeling indeed is not myself, but it's also untrue that myself is inaccessible to feeling. For it is myself that feels, myself that has a faculty of feeling. So basically, myself can actually contact feeling when it wants to, but it can actually just let feeling go when it wants to, so I don't feel anything at all. Such a one should answer thus. Suppose that feeling should become altogether totally extinguished. Now, if after the extinction of feeling, no feeling whatever exists, is it then possible to say, this I am? In other words, where do you go? There's no consciousness, and the feeling is gone. To say that the mind, or the mind objects, or mind consciousness, the mind, mano, mind objects, dhammas, or mind consciousness, mano vijnana, constitute the self, and this is what a lot of people do, such an assertion is unfounded, for an arising and passing away is there. You can actually see mind arising, especially when you have these six sense consciousness and you realize this is only one of those consciousnesses. That's one of the great advantages of that Buddhist classification. Every type of consciousness is actually different. Because when you see it's different, you actually see that one arises and the other one is not there. And when you see that some are not there, you can actually see that this mind consciousness cannot be mind. It's not always there. Sometimes you see, and the mind is not there. And then mind arises afterwards. So that actually shows that mind is not always there. And a rising and a passing away is there. And a passing away doesn't mean just a momentary passing away. It passes away for a length of time. It's gone. It's not just like, the waves on the surface. It's a whole lake disappearing. And seeing the rising and passing away of things, one would come to the conclusion that one's self arises and passes away, which doesn't make any sense. This is like the eternal core of you. Now, this is one of my favorite ones. It would be better for the unlearned worldling, that's not even a stream winner, to regard his body, built up of the four elements, as his self, rather than your mind. For it is evident this body may last a year, 2 years, or three, or four, or five, or 10 years, even for 100 years or more. And my one's lasted 59 years so far. But that which is called jitta, or mana, or consciousness, now remember this is all. Now that thing, that one thing actually imparted, that's a singular. That one thing which is sometimes people call chitta or mana or vijnana, in Pali, is this quote here, there's also quotes in the Vinaya, that these three words were actually used loosely. Sometimes people call consciousness, sometimes we call mind, just the same we do in English. Sometimes you call mind, sometimes you call consciousness, sometimes you even call heart. So what's the difference? It's just different ways of saying the same thing. And that was exactly the same in Pali as well. That one thing which is called chitta or mana or vijnana arises continually during the day and night as one thing and passes away as another thing. In other words, it arises and vanishes even more quickly than the body.
Yes.
It does. What it does, it just grounds you on some reality, which is you have feelings in the body, you can't sort of do much about them, and they arise and pass in a way in this moment. But we're not really talking about the feelings of the body, but it's just the perception of a body. Not the feelings, but the rupa kanda, because that is more stable than the mind. It lasts a long time. Vedana is even more unstable. Yeah, so when it's not active, what is it?
Yes, so the argument against that the self is potentially there, but not really. The argument against that is just, the Nirvana is going out. What does the Buddha say as an argument against someone who would say, the self is there, it's just dormant, it's not potential?
Well, okay, it means that when the five khandhas finish, then it can't perceive, it can't be conscious, it can't will. Because these are the activities of the five khandhas. So it's very clear that in Nibbana that there is no consciousness left. vijnana has ceased. There is no will. Sankaras have ceased. No thought. There is no perceptions. There are no feelings. No happiness. No suffering. No in between. There is no body. So, what is there left?
Yeah. Someone said self is dormant, it's not displaying itself, it's just like a potential to be a self, but it's not there. I think you mentioned it before, and I just kind of gave the idea, what did the Buddha give a what counter argument the Buddha gave to someone who would say that there is a self, but it's dormant, similar to potential energy. It's like, it's not activating itself, but it could be underlying.
One of my favorite lines in the VCV Maga is, there is, the cause is not pregnant in the effect, and the effect is not pregnant in the cause. I think that's what you're arguing.
So the cause and effect are different. There's also, how he's saying, like a tree has a shadow, is one of the, so you know, does a tree own a shadow? So like a shadow is almost like a potential of a tree. But when there's no sort of light, that shadow is like dormant. It's not really there. But remember, it's the sort of the tree which craves the shadow. So it has to be something which is there all the time, which somehow or other creates these five khandhas sometimes and then doesn't create these five khandhas. But even the idea of creating is the sankhara. So it's part of the five khandhas.
Right, and if there's something, then it's just the Buddha made five khandhas,
so you can't escape it. That's right, it can't be outside the five khandhas.
So that logic then doesn't make sense.
Indeed, it can't be a consciousness, it can't be a will, it can't do anything. It can't do anything, it can't know anything. Therefore, basically, it does not exist.
Right, so someone said, oh, there's a something that's not displaying itself, and you say, well, that something is part of the five khandhas.
It has to be, yeah. If it's a thing, it's part of the five khandhas.
Right, so...
five khandhas to encompass everything.
Yeah.
Like she was asking about, like, is there a soul?
Exactly, yeah. So, first of all, you know, what is a soul? If it's conscious, it's part of the five khandhas. If it feels anything, it's part of the five khandhas. If it can do anything, it's part of the five khandhas. If it has some sort of form, it's part of the five khandhas. So it has to be completely sort of separate from these things. And so after a while, what's the point? It's just like a dead log. Basically, it's just nothing. Certainly it's not blissful.
But what about those asanya beings that are just body? I mean, there was consciousness before, and then it just ceases.
Yeah.
And then there's just body. And then it arises again?
It arises again, yeah.
And then what keeps that body there in between? I mean, there must be...
It's just the calm of that place of stillness. Okay. So it's just like a pause, but a very long pause. Okay.
Okay.
So the karma is not used up, so it still comes up, comes into being again. Coming soon.
Two causes to create something, so that is also
takes
away any idea of a soul, right?
Yeah, because it can't have any soul, because it's all, of course, they take the causes away. So all these five khandhas disappear. If you ask a person, I mean, what do you mean by a soul, what do you mean by a self? And it's usually they start to sort of say the idea as a God. A self-existent being, but omniscient, omnipresent, has to do something to exist. If it doesn't do anything, it doesn't exist. That's why, you know, if somebody is sleeping, you try and wake them up. You know, if you kick them, if you shake them, then they don't do anything, they're dead. They just don't exist anymore. So that's actually fine if something exists or not, whether it does anything. Okay. Therefore, whatsoever there is of corporeality, of feeling, perception, mental formations, or consciousness, this is from the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, whether past, present, or future, one's own or external, gross or cosmic, or subtle, lofty or low, far or near, of this one should understand, according to reality, this does not belong to me. This am I not, this is not myself. So all types. To show the impersonality and utter emptiness of existence, Vasudhi Magga quotes the following verse. Mere suffering exists, no sufferer is found. Oh, what a relief that is. But when you think you are, then there's a sufferer. The deed is, but no doer of the deed is there. Nirvana is, but not the person who enters it. And the path is, but no traveller on it is seen, as I keep on saying. If now anyone should ask, have you been in past, and is it untrue that you have not been? Will you be in the future, and is it untrue that you will not be? Are you? And is it untrue that you are not? You may reply that you have been in the past, and it is untrue that you have not been, that you will be in the future. It is untrue that you will not be, that you are, and it is untrue that you are not. Great. Was that great George Bernard Shaw, this philosopher, said, you know, we don't exist, it's all just a thought. And he sort of kicked a rock, and I think he kicked this guy, and he said, I refute you thus. He kicked him to show that he was, not just a thought, because it hurt. In the past, that's actually what I said the other day with the talk on ultimate reality. In the past, only the past existence was real, but unreal the future and present existence. In the future, only the future existence will be real, but unreal the past and the present existence. Now, only the present existence is real, but unreal the past and future existence. So stop thinking about the future and stop thinking about the past. It's unreal. So ultimate reality is present moment. Now we go to dependent origination. Verily, that comes from Christianity. Don't know where you got that one from. The one who perceives dependent origination sees the Dhamma. And those who see the Dhamma see dependent origination. This is a powerful saying, because he said that this is seeing the Dhamma, seeing dependent origination. Seeing dependent origination, seeing the Dhamma. Seeing the Dhamma is being the stream winner. So seeing dependent origination is also just an essential part of being a stream winner. Why? Because it shows just how rebirth can happen without a self. It's one of the big questions. People keep asking you, you Buddhists, they don't believe in a soul, but you believe in reincarnation. It doesn't make any sense. And the answer was dependent origination. For just as from the cow comes milk, from milk comes curd, from curd comes butter, from butter ghee, and ghee from the skim of, and from ghee the skim of ghee. Whether it is milk, it's not counted as curd or butter or ghee or skim of ghee, but only as milk. And when it is curd, it's only counted as curd, not as milk. Just so was my past existence at that time real, but unreal the future and present existence. And my future existence will be at that time real in the future, but unreal the past and present existence. My present existence is now real, but unreal the past and future existence. All these are merely popular designations and expressions, mere conventional terms of speaking, mere popular notions. The perfect one indeed makes use of these without having, however, clinging to them. So you may be milk in this life, and your next life you'll be curd. You know that one comes from the other, but they're not the same. Thus, the one who does not understand body, feeling, perceptions, mental formations and consciousness according to reality, nor understands their arising and their extinction, pause there, the extinction of consciousness, the extinction of will, the extinction of perception, the extinction of feeling, and the way to their extinction, they are liable to believe that either the perfect one continues after death, or that he does not continue after death, and so forth. That was one of the wrong views. Why? Because people said, when you become an arahat, do you continue after death, or are you annihilated after death? And what was the answer to that? So, well, there's nothing here to begin with. So how can you say it was annihilated? All it was, the process was brought to an end. Nothing has disappeared. It's like the conservation of energy. How can you have sort of energy just suddenly disappear? How can you have a world come out of nothing? How can you have this great world disappear into nothing? It cannot be, because you can't get something out of nothing. And you can't have something going back into nothing, can you? What's the answer to that dilemma? The conservation of energy. And the answer is that there is, in science, negative energy and positive energy. And, as I mentioned this to Professor Blair at UWA once, said, what would it be like if the amount of positive energy in this universe just directly equaled the amount of negative energy? An example of negative energy is the potential energy. In the gravitational field, that's a form of negative energy. And he looked at me and said, wow, you're up to date, Ajahn Brahm. Omega equals one. And omega is actually the ratio of positive energy and negative energy in this universe. The scientists have already figured it out. The reason why this universe can come from nothing is still with the conservation of energy, because the sum total of energy in this universe, or mass energy, is zero. We've come from separated out some positive and negative energy, but this is a zero-sum universe. Just like your consciousness is a zero-sum consciousness. That's why it can come out of nothing and it can cease into nothing. With a complete conservation of energy. There we go. Modern physics. And even actually just recently, it's in the newspapers, the Friday newspaper if you want to look at it, Professor Stephen Hawking has come out in his new book saying that there's no need for a God to light the blue touch paper of the Big Bang. So the theories of gravity and other laws of physics show that this universe does and will spontaneously generate itself without the need of a God.
I don't believe in God.
Huh? No, no, he's come out against that now.
Ah, okay.
He said it's absolutely unnecessary.
He used to say, you know, like, I believe in God.
That's right, but he's changed. That's why it's in the newspapers.
Yeah.
He's got it right now.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what I said at lunchtime. People are actually talking about that. It's in the newspaper. The Friday newspaper, have a look at it down.
Oh, yeah.
In the office somewhere.
From West Australia?
West Australia, yeah. Wow. So, see, he's finally become a Buddhist. As he should be. Now, here we go. The two extremes, annihilation and eternity belief, and the middle doctrine. And this is the sutta from which... Oh no, this is not. Truly, if one holds the view that the vital principle, the jiva, which is another word for the soul, is identical with the body, in that case a holy life is not possible. Why not? If your soul is identical with the body, why is a holy life not possible? What's the point? In other words, you do all this hard work, you know, meditating and just keeping your precepts, and these other scallywags are out there, you know, sleeping around, drinking beer, having a good time, and at the end of your life, when we all die, we're all the same. What a waste of our time. No, but if you say it's somehow the same, it means it's a waste of time being good, because we all end up the same.
That's my biggest worry.
Yeah, if it is, you're in a problem, but I guarantee it ain't. You haven't wasted your time.
That's why the understanding of the rebirth is so important.
Yes, right, yeah, because that shows you that, oh, just getting a good meditation so your body disappears. I have an out-of-body experience. You just go and electrocute yourself, but not too much. So you just like leave the body and check it out, and then you come back again afterwards. But I never told you that. Please take it off the... I get sued. Anyway. Or, if one holds the view that the vital principle is something quite different from the body, in that case, also a holy life is not possible. Why is that? If it's quite totally different from it, again, it's totally independent of the body, whatever you do. Which means, again, it's a waste of time being good. The vital principle is still there. And that was something which I first read in Hindu teachings, where they said, this was Krishna talking to Arjuna before they went into battle. And Arjuna was, this is a really good guy. He's going into battle with his family members, like it always happens in wars. It's just other friends. He said, look, don't worry about, you know, killing and slicing off the head of your brother. He said, well, I'm going to kill him. I can't do that. He said, you can't kill him. You just, the soul in there is indestructible. You're just killing a body. You're not killing the soul. The soul keeps going on. So there's nothing you're doing. It's just They're just bodies, that's all. Nothing really important like souls. So they're saying actually the soul was totally different than the body, so you can just do whatever you want to a body. Morality becomes... You know, you're not stealing from a soul, you're just stealing from a body. So it's not wrong. You're not having sex with other people's wives. Souls don't have wives. It's just bodies. So that also makes the holy life... So both are wrong. Anyway, yeah, go on.
I'm going to say, well, if that kind of war business doesn't make any difference, there's no point having a war.
That's another point, yeah. But they didn't see it quite that way. Because it was just one of those spins to try and get people to go to war. So both these two extremes are perfect. One is avoided, and he's shown the middle doctrine, which says dependent origination. So in other words, he can't say that something actually is. So the soul is actually identical with this body, nor is it different than the body. In the sense that, you know, you're caught up with this body. So actually, where does this body come from? So we have this dependent origination. On this delusion depends the karma formations, the sankhara. Will, basically. And on his will depends consciousness, vijnana, starting with rebirth consciousness in the womb of the mother. On consciousness depends the mental and physical existence, the nama-rupa. On nama-rupa depends the six sense organs. On the six sense organs depends sensory impression, obvious. On sensory impression comes feeling. From feeling we get craving. From craving we get this fuel of clinging. From clinging we get the states of existence, they call it a process of becoming. On states of existence we get rebirth. On rebirth we get decay and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief and despair. This is called the noble truth of the origin of suffering. Now, where's that book gone? Oh, it's underneath here. Just to make it clear, the Buddha actually gives great definitions in the... here we go. In the Mahanidana Sutta, this is Dignitāra, it goes into a lot of detail here. So, it is said... This is from the Buddha. With birth as a condition, there is aging and death. Just one of these last ones. How that is so, Ananda, should be understood in this way. If there were absolutely and utterly no birth of any kind anywhere, that is, devas into the state of devas, gandhabas into the state of gandhabas, yakas into the state of yakas, human beings into the state of human beings, four-legged quadrupeds into the state of quadrupeds, winged creatures, in other words, birds into the state of birds, and reptiles into the state of reptiles, each into their own state. If there were no birth of beings of any sort in any state, then the complete absence of birth, with the cessation of birth, would aging and death be discerned? Certainly not, venerable sir. It's very, very clear from each one of these that this actually means birth. Birth, birth, birth. Not birth in the moment, yeah? That is valid, but that's not what dependent origination means. Paticca Samuppada, dependent origination, was actually said by the Buddha to be understood in this way. That's why I just read this out. To be understood in this particular way. Because it was answering that question which is often asked, you know, how did we get reborn? You know, what was the cause without a soul? We've got this actually process, especially the process of craving and delusion, the two going together, creating the fuel which creates that momentum for a future rebirth.
Because my follow-on question to that is the cessation of these factors, would it be equal to in meditation when you move into the jhana state?
No.
But adding this motion, that this only specifically refer to the rebirth.
Correct. So it has to be the cessation of rebirth. And that's not going to happen yet until you die. Rebirth can only cease once you die.
In the jhana, it's just the cessation of the khandhas.
Cessation of some of the khandhas, not all the khandhas.
Yeah.
So it's not full cessation yet.
It starts off with delusion, right?
No, it starts off with old age, suffering and death. This is how the Buddha said. Look, this is what I know. You've got old age, suffering and death. That is something I can be sure of.
Right.
How was it? What was his name? Who said the only thing you can be sure of are death and taxes.
Right.
Who was that? That was Mark Twain. That's right. So you can be sure of death. So that's a given. So he said, what causes death? It's quite obvious. Birth. Once you're born, you can't avoid death. So he said, look, that's the whole cause of this birth. As long as I get born again, I'm going to have this old age and death again. So he said, why did I get reborn? And that's actually when he looked about this process of becoming, or this state of existence, caused by this fuel of craving and will. Basically, because you want to get reborn. You just can't stop. You can't be still. And it's just, you can actually see that every moment you try to meditate, how you can't sort of stop being restless, always creating more things. And that whole process, you know, when you're meditating, you see that happening right during your meditation, why you can't be still, why you can't stop. That's going to happen when you die. And you're going to create your next birth, unless you know how to be still. So you saw actually where that all came from. First cause, yeah, no.
First cause,
yeah.
Not a
correct.
The wrong
no, it's just it's continually acting, yeah. Exactly.
That's why we start off with birth, right?
Yeah.
There is no
you start off with suffering.
Suffering.
Yeah.
Suffering.
Old age, suffering, old age, sickness, and death.
We exist. And
that's why we suffer, yeah. Now, why do we suffer? Correct. Indeed, it's not an existing thing, it's just part of the five khandhas. So it's a great thing, as Buddha said, suffering exists, we can know that. Why? And it's not because you're stupid, in the sense that if you really wise up and become just more strong, you can get rid of suffering and still have a great time in this life. So sometimes people come to meditation, what they want to do is to get more wisdom, to get more skill, so they can live in life without suffering. And you try that in this monastery and you'll still suffer. Even if you get into jhana, you'll still suffer. And after a while you realize the only real way out of suffering is not just to live in a nice place with nice food and nice companions and get jhana every afternoon. That's just not good enough. The only thing you do is make sure you don't get reborn again. That's the only way out of here. So understanding that, you understand, why do I get reborn? Where's it all come from? And it's not a self, it's just this whole process. You see how the process works. No God, no Brahma can be called the maker of this wheel of life. Empty phenomena roll on, dependent upon conditions all. Empty of a core self. That's another brilliant saying from the Visuddhimagga. No God or Brahma can be called the maker of this wheel of existence. It's empty phenomena. That's why I've told people like, or when people ask me some time ago, Ajahn Brahm, how should we sort of address you? It's emptiness. Just, you know, your emptiness. It's empty phenomena. Roll on, that's all. So that's what we do, just rolling on. It's, you know, your emptiness, Buddha Rakita, your emptiness, Nicholas. You're all empty. You're just empty phenomena, rolling on. A disciple, however, in whom avijja has disappeared and wisdom arisen, such a disciple heaps up neither meritorious nor demeritorious nor imperturbable karma formations. How come? Surely that an arahat can still make good karma? Yeah, but they still make good karma. I mean, the Buddha, look at the great karma the Buddha made. He actually created this incredible sasana. He created this amazing sort of heals so many people's problems. Isn't that great karma he made?
But it's not no karma. There has to be a self and attachment in between, because otherwise it doesn't stick to anything.
Sticks to you, because without the Buddha...
Buddha. Yeah.
So it's still there's still results of the actions. But it's not called karma, and especially because it does not give rise to rebirth. So this is not rebirth producing karma. So in a sense, and it's a valid sense, arahats still make karma. They still do things, because karma means actions, especially willed actions. But it's not coming from a sense of self, I agree. But it still has its effects on this world.
On the world, but not on that arahat.
Not on them.
It doesn't accumulate. It doesn't grow.
It doesn't create more rebirth.
And that's why they can even like kill themselves, and it's not kind of
that's right.
Karma.
It doesn't create rebirth. So the term sankhara has been rendered here by karma formation because in the context of dependent origination it refers to karmically wholesome and unwholesome volition, jhana, or volitional activity, in short karma, because the Buddha said karma is jhana, is will. Will is most important here. The threefold division of it given in the preceding passage comprises karmic activity in all spheres of existence or planes of consciousness. Can you have karmic activity in the arupa realm? When you're in jhana, is that karmically doing things? When the doer is totally gone?
Well, it's the momentum that got you there.
Yeah, okay, call that karma, yeah. But you're actually not really making karma at that point. It's just the karma of what happened before.
Oh, but that's right. But you're creating the causes for good karma afterwards, no?
No, the entering has created that karma.
Okay.
But that time you're not doing any karma. There's no volition.
And then reflecting back, that
that's right, yes. I know Venu Gunaratna asked this question. I gave this answer. He said, it's just like shooting an arrow. So shoot the arrow, you've actually directed the arrow. But once it's left the bow, it carries that direction with it until it hits the target, but you can't sort of re-aim it. So that it carries a change in a direction, but it's stuck. So it can't be changed, you can't do anything out of the time. So that's like a jhana. When the arrow is being shot, it hasn't hit the target yet. Flying through the air, cannot swerve, cannot change, but it carries a direction. Yes?
In the one candle realm, let's say, in the jhana realm, how would we understand, let's say, that being has right view or wisdom or delusion?
You can't.
What's the skillful way of understanding delusion and wisdom?
When they come out, how they look at it. Delusion is where there's a sense of self there. That's my jhana. I got into jhana. Look at me. I'm a jhana attainer. I'm much better than those other scallywag monks who can't get into jhanas. That sort of stuff.
So you need
activity. Yeah.
For there to be a view.
Yeah.
But if there's still, let's say, being that it's in the jhana realm, it still has a karma that carries on that. As either has right view or not, right? Let's say two beings in the jhana realm, one with wrong view, both nirvana, and one will nirvana.
Yeah, but at the time, you can't distinguish between them.
But if there's something that's different in those streams.
No, at that time, that moment. That's the only reality in that time. In the future, it will be different.
Ah, yeah, that's right. Hmm. Well,
yes?
The echoes generate karma. All the time, unless they're in a sort of jhana state where there's no direction.
Yeah, or unless they're sort of the arahats, where they're not creating rebirth, producing karma.
So arahats still have will, don't they?
They still, will still exists, but they don't own the will. So will still exists for an arahat. So karma is still made in that sense, but doesn't produce any rebirth.
So is something in the mind has something?
Yeah, in the sense of self.
No one there.
No one there. Yes, your emptiness. Yes, Erectus.
So it's like in the cause and effect thing that's where the views and the delusions and all that happens.
Yeah.
You mentioned in that state there's nothing different between them.
Yeah. That's right, yeah. It's where they come from, where they go to.
So it's in the cause and effect that the...
Yeah, what caused that jhana, the effect it has when you come out.
There's no Sukhutta to ask this, so I was trying to ask you earlier, what's the best contemporary translation for the word becoming?
It's existence.
Existence.
Yeah. Or state of existence. I decide... Oh, okay, I don't know one already. Thus... This is bottom of page 43. Thus, through the entire fading away and extinction of this delusion, this is dependent cessation. The entire fading away and extinction of this delusion. So what you actually see in the Dhamma, karma formations are extinguished, especially Jhana. So the extinction of karma formations, consciousness is extinguished. They call it rebirth consciousness, though. I'll come on to that in a moment. So the extinction of consciousness, the mental and physical existence, nama rupa, basically the objects of consciousness are extinguished. The Buddha gave the simile of the two sheaves of reeds, consciousness, vijnana, and nama rupa, basically the objects of consciousness. You can't be consciousness without being conscious of something. You can't have something you're conscious of without consciousness. So those two go together like sheaves of reeds. The extinction of the nama rupa, the six sense organs are extinguished. So the extinction of the six sense organs, sensory impression is extinguished, as is feeling, as is craving, as is fuel, as is the states of existence are extinguished, and no place to get reborn into. And through the extinction of the states of existence, rebirth is extinguished. Through the extinction of rebirth, there is no more decay, death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair are extinguished. Thus takes place the extinction of this whole mass of suffering. This is called the Noble Truth, the extinction of suffering. Go back to consciousness there. So when delusion is extinguished, consciousness is extinguished. Which means as soon as... when is delusion extinguished? When you become an arahat. So when you become an arahat, delusion is extinguished, karma is extinguished, and consciousness is extinguished. So once you become an arahat, you become unconscious. That's what it says here, doesn't it? It says, look, the entire fading away and extinction of this delusion, then consciousness is extinguished. No, it doesn't say that. It says you don't... The entire fading away and extinction of delusion happens at the attainment of arahat, not parinibbana. So does it mean that all our hearts are unconscious? Yes? No. This is the entire fading away and extinction of avijja. Because if this is avijja, it's the tenth of the fetters. It's only totally extinguished for the arahat. So how come? It has to be rebirth consciousness. Yes. Because when you become an arahat, what consciousness is extinguished? The arahats are still conscious. The Buddha was still conscious.
And then if the five khandhas are there, consciousness has to be there too.
Yeah. So
and
it's only
they cease, then.
It's only actually at the parinibbana, at the death, that's when all the five khandhas finish, including consciousness. So that's why there is a strong argument there to say that it is rebirth. It's the only one which makes sense. So, going back onto page 44. It usually is, but someone like Buddha Dasa and Jnanawira said, no, it's not about rebirth. But it doesn't make any sense. That's right, yeah, but it has to be, because there's no other sort of logical explanation. Truly, rebirth producing karmas, because beings obstructed by delusion, ensnared by craving. Those are the two main ones, delusion and craving, working together. Seek ever fresh delight, now here, now there. Therefore, fresh rebirth continues to come to be. So it's like there's delusion and craving. Delusion is one of the biggest things. Once you delude, you have a sense of self, then you want to do things. As I kept on saying, once you have a hand, you'll pick things up. You'll crave for things. That's what a hand does. As long as you have a sense of self, you will crave. So that's the delusion, is the main thing, and then craving. When those two are abandoned, then you will never seek fresh delight here, there. Fresh rebirth will go. And that action that is done out of greed, hate, and delusion, that springs from them, has its source and origin in them. This action ripens wherever one is reborn. And wherever this action ripens, one experiences the fruit of that action, be it in this life, the next life, or in some future life. However, through the fading away of delusion, through the arising of wisdom, through the extinction of craving, future rebirth takes place again?
No.
Ah, it's a found a corner here. Yes, no future rebirth takes place again. For the actions which are not done out of greed, hate, and delusion, which have not sprung from them, which have not their source and origin in them, such actions, through the absence of greed, hate, and delusions, are abandoned, rooted out like a palm tree, torn out of the soil, destroyed and not able to spring up again. In this respect, one might rightly say of me, I teach annihilation. That I propound my doctrine for the purpose of annihilation. And then I herein train my disciples, for certainly I do teach annihilation, but not annihilation of a soul, because such a thing doesn't exist. The annihilation, namely, of greed, hate, and delusion, as well as the manifold evil and unwholesome things. The Paticca Samuppada, the dependent origination, is the doctrine of the conditionality of all physical and mental phenomena. A doctrine together with that of impersonality, anatta, forms the indispensable condition for the real understanding and realization of the Buddha's teachings. It shows that the various physical and mental life processes, conventionally called personality, man, woman, animal, are not a mere play of blind chance, but the outcome of causes and conditions. Above all, the dependent origination explains how the arising of rebirth and suffering is dependent upon conditions, and in its second part it shows how through the removal of these conditions all suffering must disappear. Hence, the dependent origination serves to elucidate the second and third noble truths by explaining the cause of suffering, how from avijja and craving we get suffering, that's the cause of suffering, and how the end of suffering, through the end of avijja and craving, we get the end of rebirth and suffering. By explaining them from their very foundations upwards and giving them a fixed philosophical form. Mm-hmm. And lastly, I've got my little note in here from the Anguttara Nikaya 10s. When somebody asks Sariputta, what really is happiness? What really is suffering? Sariputta replied, rebirth, friend, is suffering. No more rebirth is happiness. So said the great Sariputta. So do you want to be happy, Dani? So, no more rebirth. Can you be happy today? Not really. Tomorrow? No. So the older you get, the closer you are to your parinibbana. Ooh! Yeah. Yeah. Correct.
They once had right view. That's the thing, because that's the first time that they once had right view.
Yeah.
And because of that right view, like there was no rebirth craving from there, and then at other times, oh, they have wrong view.
That's right.
There's a competition between.
Sometimes they forget.
And then they have wrong view at that time.
Yeah, their mindfulness goes.
But inevitably,
indeed.
The right view started.
Correct.
The process.
A good example of that is Ananda at the death of the Buddha. He was a stream winner. Mm-hmm. And then when the Buddha sort of said he was about to die, he went up onto a post and started crying. And he said at that point, you know, the directions just were, well, he couldn't know which directions they were. He didn't know where he was. And he said, the Dhamma was not clear to me during that time. Because he missed his great teacher. He's about to die. Basically, we say in English, he lost it. Yeah, at that time. But, you know, he was a stream winner. So he soon, you know, got himself together, realised that all things are impermanent, everybody has to go. But that was a good example of a stream winner who, at that particular time, lost his right view. Yeah. So, yeah. Now, carry on.
Yeah, I'm just oh, I can't look at it, forget that right view, and just from that moment on, I'll just have a wrong view, and that'll keep rolling. The reason why that can't happen is because they had a right view once, that starts this process, so we can't forever have wrong view, and
correct. Six more lifetimes at most.
Well, it's like if you have one experience, you will always remember that it was that way because you've seen it for yourself.
Yeah, but I guess
if you can't erase it from your mind.
But I guess having the framework, the reason why, like, not the physics behind it, but the mechanism behind that is because it's a cause and effect thing.
Of course, the effect. One is a much more powerful view than the other. Mm-hmm. It feels right. So it will eventually sort of dominate your cognitive processes.
Because it's happiness.
It's happiness, it's truth, you can recognize it.
And that's why it'll dominate
yeah.
the other one.
Correct. Correct. That's a perception and thought which hid the view. Yeah, it was perfect, but he wasn't sort of acting out of that right view. He was acting out of some of the wrong views. No, it was. Yeah, it's just like you lose something, you found it again afterwards. So it hasn't lost it forever, just misplaced it. Right, because its karmic force is so strong. That, you know, it's like these saying, once you've seen these things, you can't sort of forget them. You can put them aside for a while, but they're sort of the karmic force of influencing your karmic, your cognitive processes is so strong. A good example, the only example I have, is someone who's been like a smoker, and one day they actually, you know, see sort of an autopsy of someone who's been smoking and see just what it does to your lungs. It's just gross. So once you've actually seen that, you really yuck and realise this. Smoking is killing me, but they can't stop straight away. So, you know, but after a while, it just nags at them, nags at them, nags at them, nags at them, and they've got to get up. Level of thought perception, yeah. The view is not something which you can, is in the front of your cognitive process. It's what drives the cognitive processes from underneath. It's the perceptions and thoughts. Which is what you're really aware of. That's right, yeah.
In the talk on Wednesday,
there's mention
of
a sutra
in Abhijit Bhagavad
Gita, which Ajahn Brahmani was looking at, talked about why Sanatana. That's right, yeah. Is it known by Ajahn Brahmani? So he told me at the time, but I don't know which one it was, I never wrote it down. So Ajahn Brahmani is the one to ask tomorrow morning. Okay, just go over the page, the last page here. They have a diagram of dependent origination, because people like doing diagrams to do Abhidhamma. So you can have a look at that if you wish. And they just have this little quote here from Visuddhimagga about three particular lives. But you don't really have to really worry about that. But anyway, it says, five causes were there in the past. Five fruits we find in the present life. Five causes do we now produce. And five fruits we reap in the future life. So, what are the five causes were there in the past? Which causes life. Now, it's all about the previous page. It's number 1, 2, 8, 9 and 10. Those are five causes they had. Delusion, your karma formations, your craving, your fuel, and this creating the states of existence. Five fruits we find in the present life. And that is our consciousness, mental, physical existence, nama, rupa, sense, organ, sense, impression, and feeling. We have this, which we call body and mind, because of these five things from the past. Five causes do we now produce? We produce more delusion, karma formations, craving, upadana, and bhava. And five fruits we reap in a future life. More consciousness, more nama-rupa, more sensory experience and sense impression and feeling. So that's just a little paragraph there. Yes?
Because of that
I think a better one is go back to that simile of the shipwrecked sailors. Once you've seen dry land, you know, you've got to swim to it. Yeah, you can mess around a little bit and have a little paddle, play with the dolphins. But you know, so you've got to, you know, go out to dry land sooner or later. So you can't get it out of your head, you know it's safe. You can waste time. But you know you have to do it.
But it seems like that simile is not good enough because it's kind of like a simile. So let's say someone could say, oh, well, you can forget in the next life. But having kind of like a little mechanism that is rational, kind of like the right view, it's not less craving. Is that a correct way
of... That's one way of saying it, yeah.
Is that an okay way of understanding?
Yeah, I think it's just that once you have the right view, it's something underlying which you can never forget. So it will always bring you back to that right view. You can forget in the next life. That's one of the great questions. And you know, that once you become a stream winner in this life, then when you get reborn as a human being, are you a stream winner when you come out of your mother's womb? When you come out of your mother's womb, have you got absolute faith in the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha? And if the first words you say is not mummy and daddy, but Sabbe Sankara Anicca. Yeah, what I actually say is that, other masters said this as well, they said that, well, if you're a stream winner in the previous life, you're not sort of even a Buddhist when you get reborn. You know, you can get into all sorts of other stuff, but you have to come back to it before, you know, in this life. You have to re-experience the same seeing of the Dhamma which you saw in the previous life. It's got an imprint in the mind. That imprint can never be ignored.
Or in other words, the karma formation from the last birth or death
has to give rise to this result in this life of the same experience of seeing the shore.
Did you say that was the correct way though?
Yeah.
Right view doesn't give any craving, because you can't crave if you have the right view, so there's like less craving, like
foot off the pedal? You foot off the pedal, but you put your foot back on the pedal again afterwards.
And then you
realise what it's like.
And then it's less
pain. Yeah. It leaves an imprint. It's like a trauma. But a positive trauma. Like, you know, if you've had an accident. You know, sometimes people are afraid of driving in the car or going to that same place again. It's a karmic imprint into the mind. Happiness and just the profundity.
And
see non-self. Where there's no self, there's no craving. So there we go. Dependent origination. And that ended the right view. The first factor of the Eightfold Path. And there's several more to go. But don't worry. Because the other ones are much shorter. We're almost halfway anyway now. So... Yeah, that's because I make it very big. But you can see in here, the one I make really big is right mindfulness, because they're really into that one. But we'll all go into all of those the next time, which is next week, same time, same place. See you there.